All right, guys, what's up? Welcome after our little 2-week break there to Story Time with Tofu. I hope everyone had a great Thanksgiving or non-holiday related fun if you don't celebrate the holiday over this past break period. Yeah, as usual, tradition, I haven't had a real Thanksgiving in 6 years, but we did make a lot of Japanese food, so I guess that's going to be classic for me coming up then. But so we got a lot of TV to catch up on. A lot of things happened over Thanksgiving break, other than a lot of network shows going on break for the week. We got 2 new episodes of The Leftovers since our last episode, 2 new episodes of The Nick, 2 new episodes of Fargo, as well as a whole new awesome series called AKA Jessica Jones. Excuse me, Marvel's AKA Jessica Jones. So we have a lot to talk about, and my hope this week is I've discovered, I don't know why I didn't think about this before or use logic to put together how the world works. I'm hopefully going to be able to Skype interview with my good friend Kiana, because I really would like to get a female voice on the show, and especially about a series like Jessica Jones. So we won't dwell too much on that today. If you have some time before the next podcast drops, probably either on Monday of next week or sometime this weekend, I do highly encourage you to watch the first couple of episodes of that. I don't think she's finished the series. We're both around episode 7 or 8 out of 13. It's a long, dark show, but it's definitely, there's still something about it that makes it very bingeable. So feel free to check that out. But we're going to cover that today. We're going to talk about really big things happening in The Leftovers, really subtle things, like, no, kind of subtle. No, yeah. Subtle, big names, subtle actions in The Nick. I don't know. I try to be clever and I'm failing at it. I'm sorry. But, and then I will talk briefly about Fargo. My goal is, before the season finale in 2 weeks, I'm going to get Nate back on here. We'll get another really in-depth talk about Fargo. And then I might talk a little anime. Oh, got a lot on the docket today. So, let's start with the big one. November 20th was Friday when Netflix dropped their new installment of the Marvel's Defenders series that they're producing, called AKA Jessica Jones. Which, you know, you heard me rave about that 2 weeks ago on my podcast. I was really excited, and my prayers were answered. It wasn't a True Detective 2 situation at all. And if you need, again, more background on that, Jessica Jones is a former superhero. You kind of, or they tone that down a bit in the series, but she's someone with powers who's tried to be the hero, and you kind of discover why she's no longer able to do that. She's a private eye. There's a very much more kind of noir element to this than Daredevil. Daredevil had a lot more classic, like, comic book hero elements of it, with, I think, a lot more gritty street combat martial arty tones than, you know, a lot of the other Marvel series. This is not, again, an attempt to redo that. This is telling its own story, and I'm sure in the next 5 episodes there will be some sort of Daredevil crossover, but it's definitely going to stand on its own entity, and I'm kind of glad. I'm interested to see what the show The Defenders looks like, but I'm honestly kind of hoping that we get maybe like 4 episodes of that, and I want another season of Daredevil, and I want another season of, especially more, I want more seasons of this series. Now, on the docket, Marvel says, along with Netflix, they also have planned for it, because there can't be just 2 Defenders. They're doing 2 more series. They might add on to that. But if they follow the formula, likely this coming summer or next fall, we're getting a Luke Cage, a.k.a. Power Man story, who also is a fairly prevalent character in Jessica Jones. They're not shying away from that. Yeah, he's pretty important to her story, but he's also getting his own story type of situation. And also, you know, nice, handsome black man. I should learn the actor's name. He's really, really hot. I'm sorry. He's, like, actually gorgeous, and he's, like, those perfect, like, piercing superhero eyes. Like, not the kind that, like, disarm you. Like, you kind of, you know how, like, you know, like, you think of like your dream crush, his eyes just like pierce right through you, like melt you inside or whatever. He doesn't have that kind of piercing eyes. He has the kind of piercing eyes that just makes him look like a good person. Just like, you could be the sheriff, you could be like the general of the benevolent general of troops or anything, and he's also just an Adonis. He's just gorgeous. So check it out. Just talking about that. I don't want to talk too much about Kristen Ritter because we all know she's gorgeous. She's amazing. I have too many fantasies to declare on here, and we don't want to go down that rabbit hole on this series. So other reasons to watch that series. I'm interested to see how, again, I haven't finished the series, but I'm interested to see how they're going to follow this up. Mostly because this is resonating on a lot more fronts than I think a comic book series typically would. Again, like, a lot of positive reviews around Daredevil, but it still didn't... I would say it still didn't pierce through to as broad an audience as this show is appealing. Mostly because, you know, a lot of people that watch Daredevil is like, this is boring and just stupidly violent. You know, and they weren't as interested in, like, oh, they, you know, took a really interesting time explaining this type of villain, or like, this is just shot so differently, like it feels like a different has a completely different tone than the other Marvel series. So Jessica Jones took all of the positive Daredevil, you know, the things about setting up a new universe, telling a different type of story, especially setting a different tone for an entire series. Jessica Jones took all of that plus more by creating a very empathetic, compelling and fascinating female character. Again, hats off to Kristen Ritter. She's doing a great job. Who knew the Bee from Apartment 23 could do this? And then of course, a very relevant social topic. I mean, it's basically talking about consent, and you know, I don't want to give too many spoilers, but like, you can, if you look up who Jessica Jones is, this is a fact. She's someone who's been a victim. And how she deals with her trauma is a really big part of this series. I don't want to beat around the spoilers rule, okay? You guys listen to the series, you know if you're going to hear spoilers to stop or fast forward or stop listening, you know that. And again, if you have to stop now because you want to go see the show without any spoilers, please do so. But, I mean, this is a character and a series that's dealing with a very important topic, right? It's the topic of consent and rape. This is a character who's, by all means, what we as society characterize as a strong woman. She's charismatic. She's outgoing and attractive. She's also strong. She has superpowers. She could beat up any man. No man could physically stop her. And she's, you know, fast. No man should be physically able to catch her. But, you know, at the end of the day, what's nice reminder about the Marvel series in general, but more specifically the Marvel Defenders series on Netflix so far, is that no matter what abilities you have inside, you're still a human being. And Jessica Jones is a very real and honestly very disturbing reminder of that. Anyone can be a victim, and anyone can feel these things. It's not anyone's fault. It's obviously someone's fault, but it's never your fault. It's never, you know, it tackles a lot of those issues, mostly because, and here's the big one, again, if you're deep in spoilers already, so if you're still worried about that, please turn this off. It's about a character who has Professor Xavier-level mind control, but, you know, with the power of suggestion. You know, if he basically can do this, if I had his power and I told, and all of you were near me enough, and I said, go eat your shoe, you would all eat your shoe willingly. You don't know why you eat your shoe, but the scary thing is, and the thing is, you feel the sensation of wanting to. Let's use this time now. We won't talk too much about the show again, because I want you to watch it if you haven't, and I appreciate it if you're still listening to this. But what I want you to think about, let's talk about mind control. So, obviously, everyone's pretty big example of mind control in my mind comic books is Professor X. You know, his mind is so strong he can freeze you because he stops, you know, the thoughts in your mind. So, obviously, on the level compared to the villain in the series named Kilgrave, his power, you know, is exceedingly much stronger and probably would be a pretty good way to stop Kilgrave. But there are two ways Professor X can take over your mind. He can close off certain memories and plant false ones. He can just exert his will through it, like using you as a vessel. Or subtly, he can make you think you're going crazy. He can like plant a voice here and there. He can do, you know, he has a wide range of ways he could get you to do what he wants. Kilgrave's is a little more one-dimensional in terms of how the mechanics of it technically work. But what's awesome about this series, as well as how creative, you know, the writers, as well as the original creator of this character is with these powers. You know, Kilgrave's power is, again, like, I tell you to do something and you want to do it and you're compelled to do it purely because of the way my brain is affecting yours, such and such. But, you know, so you think, oh, well, that's really easy. You just, you know, you can see when someone's being controlled by them and you know not to hurt them, or, like, you know, it's following you. But the film noir aspect and the really nice private eye aspect is the instilling of the paranoia that accompanies PTSD of something like this. And the fact that the terrifying reality of it, of this series, is that those paranoias are an actual reality. You know, basically, power of suggestion is this. I tell you, you know, we had a lovely time, and you think we had a lovely time. And as soon as you go home in exactly 2 hours, you're gonna brush your teeth without toothpaste until your gums bleed. You would walk home. You would greet your husband as though nothing would, or I could say that, and you act as though we'd never met. Nothing had happened weird. You just start, you know, like. The amount of time and the amount of suggestion that anyone could be his agent is just so well done in this series. The atmosphere is absolutely encompassing. You feel trapped there with her. And I love it. Again, but sorry, I'm going to be repetitive again this episode. This is not the lightest of shows. Again, very, very bingeable. Sorry, I'm just repeating myself. Very, very bingeable, but prepare for some darkness. Not certain episodes of the Nick or the Leftovers level darkness, but definitely like a lot of psychological darkness. But okay. Enough said about Jessica Jones. I want the next time I discuss this to be a lot more enjoyable for you guys, so I'm going to hold off a lot of comments for that. Hopefully, again, there were some spoilers there, but I hope you choose to watch this show. It's really easy. All of you have Netflix, and if you don't, you should have it, and if you tell me you don't, I still probably won't believe you, because there's no way you don't have access to Netflix unless you're in a foreign country that doesn't have access to these titles. Moving on. Okay. Really, really big things happening in The Leftovers. Okay, so these last 2 weeks confirm two major things for us. And let's start with my reaction to it from the episode 2 weeks ago, titled International Assassin. The way International Assassin worked is, so at the end of the episode before that, Kevin kills himself. He wakes up in a hotel room. Again, I'm sure this something like this is in the book, but can someone like actually tell me what this is? I would like to know like the first whole like, oh, hell and heaven or the afterlife is just like a hotel or like this benign space. Like I want to know the first example of that. Like, because I feel like it's become like a trope or a motif, and I don't know if it's overused. Like, I enjoyed it. It worked for this, but I definitely I definitely thought a lot of, like, maybe it's because I thought of too many comedic examples of when that's the case. But anyway, side note, that was my question to you guys. Wakes up in the hotel. The elderly black man, I believe his name is Rufus, or is that the name from the Nick? Anyway, is there with him and explains that he's there to guide him. And he killed himself to be there, basically. Quote, as he said in the previous episode, he's atoning. Now, the big thing that I kind of didn't take as seriously till later in the episode was don't drink the water, which is that okay, that's definitely a Greek thing, because that's why what's her name? Dimitri's daughter. Oh my god, why can't I remember? Is it Ophelia? It's not Ophelia. It's Hades' wife who can't leave hell for half the year because she ate some of the food there. Like, you get, like, once you eat or consume something in the other world, you're part of that. Okay. All in all, Kevin goes on a really long journey. He's able to come to terms with Patty in a very... God, in a very classic Leftovers existential, grippingly over-the-top type of way. But it felt satisfying and real. And, of course, crawls out of the ground where... I believe John's son... Oh God, I'm so bad at names in this show. John Murphy's son is there waiting for him. And it's like, whoa, praise God. So here's the real question that this episode left in my mind. Is we don't know what Kevin drank. It could have been something that's supposed to induce a death-like state for several hours between resurrected. Like, this show does an incredible job of constantly challenging your own beliefs of the series, whether or not supernatural things are actually happening, or whether this is all, you know, elaborate coincidence and one man's post-traumatic experience of the world. You know, Laurie even breaks it down in this season. Everyone was in such a state of trauma after October 14th when the event happened that they're willing to believe anything. And that's further along the lines that Tommy has now been convincing people that he can hug away your pain. So, but we'll go into that more when we get to this week's episode. So what we either have to believe now, or don't, you can constantly keep questioning it, which is why I enjoy the series, is there a greater, you know, is there something beyond the, you know, the constantly turning gyre? Is there a destiny-like clock, a clock of fate in the background, carefully moving all these pieces for what appears to be, so far, just a bizarre, more or less an out of the ordinary purpose? Or is this just about crazy people in the face of an unexplicable trauma that we'll never know? Like, the best part of this literally is if this were to happen in this world tomorrow, I don't know if any of the events in the show would happen exactly the way they were, but all of us would be stuck feeling the exact same way. Oh, we have no idea. And unfortunately, based on current technology or understanding of the way supposed magical energy interacts with this earth, we will never know. And yes, I'm sure there are tons of people watching this series, and a part of me wants to know too, like, what does it all mean? Where are we all going? Where are they all going? What happened? Blah, 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 blah. You know, the guilty remnant believed the world ended that day. But I really, really, really hope that we stay in this, true to the state of what they're trying to convey, this, like, unexplicable guessing between both. And I'm gonna step back into this again and reference the bird and the miracle. And what is a miracle? Or sorry, let me rephrase that. What I believe the writers are trying to play with the idea of what a miracle is. And it's all about perspective. And that's what's becoming incredibly clear in these more recent weeks. And okay, let me take it one step even further back. It has been described that fans of The Walking Dead are constantly worrying and wondering who's going to make it, who's going to die. Like, oh, we hope so and so doesn't die. Like, oh, it's unfair if who dies. Like, you know, and every episode is kind of like, you know, supposedly we're at the edge of our seats because anyone could die at any time. And you know, the characters' idea is that, you know, there'll be a time where they don't have to live like that anymore. We don't have to live in fear, running over each other's shoulder, you know, losing people all the time. But unfortunately, at that point is when no one will continue to want to watch the series. And so it was very interestingly brought up, I think, in a Vulture article. I don't remember the author, I apologize. And also on the Hollywood Prospectus and in an Andy Greenwald article, that we watch this series because we want to watch people die. We want the constant feeling of anxiety that this show brings about life and death. Slash, everyone also knows we watch the show because we want to see people violently kill zombies slash violently deal with each other. So we got that out of the way. But yes, that's also a reason I enjoy watching that show. But now back to the leftovers. So what's nice about this is there is no direct path. Like, oh, we want to live in a world where this shit doesn't happen. Well, I guess at its simplest stripped down form, you could say they want to know what happened, where everyone went on the 14th. And that was very, 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 very clear in the first season. And they're not playing around with that as much anymore. But I think the idea that The Leftovers tries to a lot more subtly instill in you, and does so very successfully in the second season, is like, who's behind, who's the man behind fate? Like, why are these things happening? That's the constant in both seasons, is everyone wants to know why, and not necessarily the characters in the show, but you as an audience, more so than a lot of other series. Like, I feel like the most moments I say why, like at the end of an episode or in the middle of the episode, is when something so stupid and ridiculous happens, usually in a CW series or like a network television show. Because, you know, and again, like, this is just my interpretation of it. The character is supposed to discover the why, and we're supposed to, you know, enjoy the how and benefit kind of from the final moment. But it's more supposedly about this character's journey. What's becoming increasingly clear to me about my perception about The Leftovers, and it's probably very different for others who watch this, or it might be similar, but I think, you know, everyone has a different take on this, is that I just don't want the mystery to end. I like this constant play around, and I think this frustrated people with the first season. I like this constant beating around the bush that you're never going to get a direct answer. That's just, it's impossible. It's dumb. And this, of course, will change a bit when we get to next week, and this current week's episode, which I just watched. But you're constantly beating around the bush. And if you can keep a show in that perpetual state and more focus on the way the characters are dealing with that, versus, you know, how the character's effects on the world is, you know, affecting our understanding of the if we can watch characters in this constant state of wanting and unknowing this, with never, and honestly potentially knowing we're never going to get an answer, is it worth investing in the narrative? And for me, it's yes. I don't mind being jerked around. Basically, that's jerked around on the line for hours upon hours, not knowing where I'm going or how I'm going to get there. Because I enjoy the ride. That's that's what International Assassin resulted in. Oh, and it was nice to see, like, a lot of reunions of the other characters and blah, 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 less more generic talk about that episode. But now we get to this past week. Kevin is woken up. He's actually not in this episode. It's doing another classic, oh, while Kevin was dead, this is what was happening. And we return to probably my two least favorite characters on the show, who at first were not at all delivering, but by a third of the way through the episode, I was into it, and I'm kind of happy with the choices. So, if you recall, the first three episodes of the season, episode one establishes the Murphy family and the town of Jordan in the National Park of Miracle, which is very important to clarify. Miracle is not the town. It's the national park. The town is called Jordan. Sorry, someone really obnoxiously said that in the last episode. But episode two was Nora Durst and Kevin Garvey with their daughter Jill. And the baby, I should know her name. Baby Ellie, I think. And then episode three was about Lori Garvey and Tommy. And if you recall, at the end of that episode, we run into Meg again, who, as Tommy puts it, fucks him while he's naked and, like, handcuffed in, I think it's like a semi-truck, in the back of a semi-truck, with no explanation. And we don't see those, and we honestly haven't really seen her till now. So, like a lot that's been revealed in the season, what we get in this episode is we learn, if you recall, it's said but never shown that Meg didn't lose someone on the 14th. She lost someone the day before. And I think it was described that she was never given time to grieve, or like she was robbed of the experience of the emotional experience or comfort because something terrible happened the day after. But so basically, she's gone full cult. We see a meeting in this episode where she's being told she's being too violent and radical, and I love this. I think it's kind of dumb, but I also love this line. She's like, why stand on their lawns and stare at them until they want to come scream in my face when I can put my cigarette out in their eye? She's like, oh, okay. Also, a nice little side appearance from Indra. I don't know if you remember her from the 100. She's a chieftain. Anyway, she's in the Guilty Remnant. Moving on. She convinces Tommy to join her. And it what basically looks like is a takeover of Miracle. And in quote, the 14th is coming up, and as we know, the Guilty Remnant's whole idea is we need to make everyone remember that the world ended. And Meg just says, like, these people were spared this, so we have to make sure they understand in the similar fashion. Before we talk a little bit more the nuances of where the show is going, I'm just going to tell you what happened at the end of the episode. Huge reveal. The girls who went missing in episode one and we've been constantly looking for are actually with Meg. The connection is this episode starts with a flashback of her and her ex-fiancé visiting Jordan, probably about a year before, or 6 months before the first episode of the first season began, and they visit Isaac, the black psychic, who can see your future with a handprint, or in this case, talk to loved ones past. And she encounters Evie randomly there. It's a very strange, oh, do you want a baby carrot? Because no one can cry, you need a baby carrot kind of moment. But so that's the connection there. But episode ends on that. Tommy sees that the girls are living in a trailer and are now allegedly look like they're part of the Guilty Remnant. Okay. Mystery's over. But what they've done a good job is still where is it all going? Cool. I'm fine with that. I wasn't expecting this. And that leads me to believe. And that raises. And the reason that's important is because the reason I thought they were gone for good is because Patty told Kevin that, oh, and those girls, Kevin, they're never coming back. They're gone. And that's when she's explaining that he tried to kill himself. Now, these are allegedly all happening when Kevin's blacked out and sleepwalking. But apparently your subconscious is still active during those times, which is how, like, in those movies, people BS, they, like, bring out, oh, you blacked out, so we had to tap into your subconscious to figure out how you got there or something. Okay, so if we acknowledge that Patty is part of this weird supernatural experience that is haunting Kevin, and that by killing himself and vanquishing her, or he, like, was able to move past that. What Lori is telling him is arguably that he's a schizophrenic psychotic, and he had a psychotic break, and this is, his brain is so traumatized by, so traumatized that it just was willing to accept this story, and that Patty knew nothing beyond what he knew. So, we still don't know what happened to the water in Jordan. We still don't know what happened to all that water, how it all got sucked up. But we can say for certain... Oh, but that's the thing. Can we say for certain? We can't... Okay, we can't say for certain Kevin did not see what happened to the girls. And if Kevin didn't see what happened to the girls, it is likely Patty would make up a story. And by Patty, I mean the Patty being created by Kevin's psyche, if that is exactly what is going on. Because, you know, it is incredibly coincidental that a man was resurrected after, you know, allegedly committing suicide. So that's the state of the show. It's, you know, constantly challenging what you want to believe in. That's the lesson here, I suppose. But what I mostly wanted to talk about, which is a pretty important part, especially if you've been listening to the show, you've been listening to this podcast, you don't watch the series, and it's mostly because you hated season one, or hated the early episodes of season one. I really, really want to insist to you that this is a very different show. And my example for you is this. In episode one, yes, spoilers, they show a woman being physically stoned to death. It's quite horrifying. I think if I hadn't watched so much really messed up anime, I would have been far more disturbed. But that really hit a sour note with a ton of people, mostly because it felt incredibly undeserved, whatever it means to be deserving of anything. But it felt unnecessary. And not in a productive, I'm trying to make a statement kind of way, more just like, oh, I did this because I thought it'd be shocking to show a woman on TV getting stoned to death. Again, wasn't upset at some people, but definitely can see how that could have been a poor choice. We're kind of reminded about that in this episode in a very subtle way. I'm not sure if everyone caught it, but I think they allegedly stoned someone to death in this episode as well. But it is all done off screen. And my friend said, who hasn't seen the first season, and I was like, oh, Nate, isn't that a much better than... And he's like, I don't know what you mean. It still implies that someone was definitely stoned to death. And I'm like, yes, just based on the fact that you had that reaction, wouldn't you be outraged if you physically saw someone being bloodied by stones on screen just now? He's like, yeah. It's like, that to me is the transition. You're less bogged down with all of that over the top. What in my opinion, sometimes work. All of the over the top BS to actually appreciate the mystery and honestly more of the anxiety of the series that I think are the more important themes than, you know, over the top angst and trauma, blah, blah, blah. Because, as I said in early episodes, the softer you are, or the more subtle you are in creating your world, when someone has to break the mold, or, you know, in this case, when someone finally cracks, it's incredibly effective. Whereas if everyone cracks at multiple points in every episode of a series doing crazy, weird shit, like branding each other, I don't know, I think my friend hated that scene, then, you know, it loses its impact. It very much loses its impact. And from a storytelling perspective, this second season of the show has not has been doing that incredibly well. It has been using its intense and what can be seen as over the top beats and moments to affect not just yourself in the episode, but your overall understanding of the way the narrative is moving in the series, as well as the world around the narrative is evolving, which is very important because this is, you know, alternate history, alternate universe type of situation. Okay, so that was a lot about The Leftovers. I'm sorry about that. But again, if you haven't watched season one, please try to power through it. If you kind of want a weird... No, I disagree. You can't watch this second season without watching season one. So you'd have to do both. But it's a lot softer. I think you'll ask yourself very interesting questions. And more importantly, you get to see some weird shit. That's why we watch television. It's like that Rick and Morty quote. It's like, who wants to narcissistically look at their future, like other lives, or just sit here and watch TV? It's like, yeah. Sit here and watch TV. But okay. Check out The Leftovers. We have two more episodes of that left. So let's move on to The Nick. Okay. I don't want to dwell on this show too much. I think I'm going to do both an article as well as hopefully a really long singular podcast about The Nick when this season is finally over. But this, if I gave season one an 8 out of 10, this is definitely a 9 or 9.5 out of 10. This is not easy to watch, but it is incredibly, incredibly good television. It's compelling, it's fascinating, and the fact that the camera uses... The fact that the camera placement is done so meticulously and particularly to give a very voyeur feel, as well as kind of at the same time forcing you into the mind of all of the many characters of this series in every single scene, is beyond amazing. It's something that honestly not much else on TV is doing at all. So that's why that's getting a huge bonus. But in the past two episodes, the main trend that I did want to talk about, mostly because I kind of don't know what opinion to form on this. I just have a few kind of ideas. And if you're watching the show, or if you kind of hear these things, I'd love to know what you think about it. So Eve Hewson, who's the glorious, Bono's daughter, was the young, naive nurse from West Virginia in the first season of the show. I think she's fresh out of NYU acting, or NYU Tisch School. And she's taken a much bigger role in this season. Season one, she was a little bit proppy. She's kind of whiny. And this is not a reflection of Eve Hewson as an actress. This is more the way her character was written. And I think they did take a lot of criticism that the female characters of the show weren't as compelling as they could be. So they really ramped that up this episode because honestly, some of my favorite scenes are between Harriet, who is the nun who would perform abortions, and Cleary, the like scumbaggy with a heart of gold ambulance driver. Their scenes together are absolutely... It's hard because it's around kind of really sad subject matter and like kind of in a rut subject matter, but there's so much life and depth to both of those side characters that, you know, a lot of secondary characters in other series just don't have. And I'm kind of more interested to see how it's going to connect into the greater picture, because they still have tasks with a lot of the other main characters, but they've kind of been off on their own in their own space. Almost like we could have a show probably just about them, like a 25-minute period, almost dramedy about their relationship. So I hope it doesn't fall flat, and I hope they don't use what is seemingly forming a really happy, progressive, benign relationship as to something to wreck as just like a, you know, with a, you know, just for the sake of making life seem harder. But their current ploy is contraceptives. As Cleary put it, you can't do the fix anymore, Harriet, but be damned if we can't do something for these girls and make a profit. So I believe they're going to make condoms. Yes, that is what they're doing. They're making condoms. But again, weird side notes that I believe it was the bridge that said there are too many side plots going on, but I love that. And there are arguably a lot of side plots going on in the Nick, some of which aren't too overlapped with what is seemingly the main story of the hospital. But so far, the only one I'm kind of getting sick of is I'm cheating on my wife with a prostitute and trying to buy her freedom and skimming money off the rich. But sorry, I'm sidetracked so far from Eve Houston. But anyway, like a lot of the other female characters like Harriet, Eve Houston has also been given a pretty big step up in this series. And what's important is it's given her a new lens, a new focus for her character. We're now a lot more unsure of what exactly she wants, but her actions are indicating that she clearly wants something. She wants something more. She wants to be taken seriously. She wants to be considered an intellectual, considered a society type. And she realizes that, I think, after this horrifying interaction with both Clive Owen as a lover while he was a drug addict and her very, now it's apparent, abusive father, she's realized nothing's going to be given to her, and she's going to figure out how to earn and take things on her own. So she started to read medical textbooks. She's becoming the most efficient nurse on the staff. And most importantly, she's caught the ever-wandering eye of Juliet Rylance's brother in the series, Henry Robertson, who also is becoming quite the pornographer. Speaking of Walking Dead fans, the actress who played Beth is a nurse in this series, if you're a fan. I need to learn that actress's name, I forget. But anyway, we're at 42 minutes. I'm sorry, guys. What I'll end on talking about the Nick so I can get in a little Fargo licks there is there's a lot better balance this season between juggling the stories of the two main characters, it's hard to say the main characters, but the Don Draper focal point character, which is in this case Clive Owen and the rest of the cast, as well as evolving these kind of period issues over the course of the season. I felt like it felt a little more episodic in the first season in terms of discovering certain things and certain events happening, whereas a micro event along the timeline, for example, of the subway being built, has been a plot device in a specific episode, but they're very much continuing it out throughout the season, and it's making one comment I had about it, it is reminding you that things happen a lot slower in this time period, which is kind of nice to remember, because again, the show constantly does a good job of pulling you back and forth from the past and present and making you think about making you think about status and progress and medicine and, oh my god, do I have this weird disease. Oh, and a fun thing too is when you get to watch this show, you get to text, instead of going on Wikipedia, fun thing, text your med school friends the questions that come up on this. I think, in a surgery in this episode, someone mentions the pouch of Douglas, and right there is where you should feel the pouch of Douglas, and I think I posted that on my friend's Facebook who's in med school, and someone else just posts, dude, the pouch of Douglas is the supposed space between the uterus and the anus. And she's just like, why are you asking this question? But anyway, since that was a terribly boring story about me, my only comment is, if you're not watching Fargo, please, please do. I know I just went in length about how I really enjoy The Leftovers, really have been enjoying The Nick, but Fargo is by far the best show this fall. It has all the unique stylistic choices that the Nick offers in terms of cinematography, storytelling, and of course use of a score. But more importantly, the Nick is a very new entity on television, and its beats, the way its episode unfolds, isn't necessarily a neat puzzle piece, if that makes sense. It's a lot more jagged. The episode structure is a lot more sporadic, although the visual element, the lens, is very singular. The story doesn't flow as well as a TV narrative. Not that it's a bad TV narrative, it's just a new style. Flow as well as a TV narrative as Fargo does. Things that Fargo does that unnatural, like TV, of course, like the Nick, you know, take space, using really interesting music choices, using the strange split screen in very artistic ways, making you look for things beyond what the story is, etc., etc. But it's a show that you watch, which strangely runs often over an hour and a half on FX because they air it so late at night. With, I think they're about 50 plus minute episodes with commercials sometimes, or a little over an hour of content each. So it does play out, I guess, suppose, more like a mini series than average television. But when you actually do watch this on TV, the beats flow out, the easiness it is to move from scene to scene, from character moment, and remember characters, is so perfect. Again, The Americans is another show I absolutely love, like The Nick. Both of those series are very hard to watch. They're very dense pieces, not incredibly dense, but they're much denser pieces of television to absorb and enjoy than, you know, say something like Blindspot on NBC. What's nice about Fargo is, similarly to, I think, Breaking Bad as well as Mad Men is for some, is that it's incredibly easy to watch. It's a long hour sometimes because, you know, some people like that 42-minute, I'm just going to watch this on Netflix type of time framing. But if you have DVR, it doesn't matter. Excuse me. Nearing the end of my rope here. But it is an incredibly easy episode of television to enjoy. There's a lot of great... It's dark humor at its finest, I suppose. I'm trying to think of... if I can think of a way to nicely niche this together without being too wordy, but I don't think it's going to come to me. I can't do it. It's been a long day. What we're going to end it on is basically, excuse the discussion of Fargo, is that, in my opinion, it is the best series being made on television as we speak. I'm glad it's been renewed for a third season, despite dismal rating numbers, because I don't know if people forget it's on, but I'm not kidding. This show is addictive. It's funny. It's thrilling, it's hilarious, you care about these characters, you see amazing things being done with the camera, with the landscape, and more importantly, with non-diegetic and diegetic sound. It's created its own little world, and it's done it with the highest level of professionalism and artistry. So, again, I only just spent, 4 or 5 minutes talking about this show compared to the other half hour I spent talking about The Leftovers and Jessica Jones. But if you have to be watching something right now, if you have to say, okay, I need a series to watch one episode a day for the next week, it is Fargo. If you haven't seen season one, that's fine. Still watch season two right now, and you can go back and watch season one. It doesn't matter. But this is the show. This is the number one must-watch show of this year, hands down. And that's all that needs to be said. I'm done. We'll talk about more of this when I get a buddy on. We'll talk about more of this when the series is finally ended. Last little side note. So I don't know if you guys know this, but they announced, I think, about a year ago, maybe a little less than that, that Digimon was getting rebooted in Japan. And yes, they have continued to make new Digimon after the original series, but they are bringing back the original cast. Yes, that's right. Tai, or Taichi, you know, TK, Kari. I actually keep mixing up their English and Japanese names, but the original Digidestin are back. And it is available on Crunchyroll, and I believe it's coming to Hulu as well. So if you want a really fun, nostalgic look back at Digimon, and a really awesome, artistic, and properly voiced with Japanese voice actors type of series, check out Digimon Adventure Try on online. Okay, guys. Thank you so much for bearing with me through this episode. Hopefully I'll have a nice, friendly female voice of Kiana Ewok Stevens on this podcast pretty soon to talk about Jessica Jones and in general the whole comic book movement right now. I again hope all of you are staying warm in this winter season, and if you're back home in Hawaii and one of my listeners there, I hope you're enjoying life. Go to the beach for me. But thanks guys, and have a great week. Bye-bye.